Some things, say the wise ones, are not living. I say, live your life your way and let me live mine. Mary Oliver is a treasure. She's not a Unitarian Universalist, though I suspect she is quoted more often than any other author in our congregations. Like Annie Dillard and Wendell Berry and Ralph Waldo Emerson and Rachel Carson, her work is about noticing. Noticing the earth, the wild, the tree, the river, the stars, the grasshopper, this one I mean. The bird song, or terrifyingly, its absence. To notice. And to see there in the world outside your window, in the garden and the wilderness, something that matters. Something that matters. Something worthy in its own sake, something woven, connected, something that we are part of from the same seed, the everything seed, blooming in countless ways, blooming right here and now. This week, as I was preparing this sermon, of course, Scott Pruitt finally was forced out at the EPA. We'll see. Not because of his efforts to increase pollution or scrub science from his department, but because of his graft, his corruption and venial money-grabbing ways, which were finally too embarrassing, which is saying something. But of course it comes from the same place, right? The sense that one might steal from the earth is tied to the notion that one might steal from the people. Because this is what we're talking about today, a sense that the earth, our home, the universe, life, the web, the whole is sacred, is the location of value, mystery, wonder, and ethics that it is not for our taking. That in fact there is no us and it, but one blooming, one web, and we are but one of the self-aware beings in this web, not its master or owner. Wonder and ethics and religion are intertwined. I say that life is intrinsically sacred. And so some thoughtfulness, some respect is due. I say that human lives are intrinsically sacred. They matter, and so some respect is due. This doesn't answer every ethical question, but it is the right place to start. To start with mystery, with wonder, with a sense of the sheer power, the enormity of the laws that transverse the universe and make us, us, and all things, things. To be humble, to be so small, and yet connected to something so large. Are you all game for a little history lesson, learning a little about Unitarian and Universalist theology and the corresponding history of environmentalism? The answer, I better be yes, because I don't have another sermon, so this is it. Here we go. I asked for ideas last spring. This was one of them. People said, oh, I like that idea. So, 1838, a small, stuffy chapel in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Ralph Waldo Emerson, who has left the Unitarian ministry to be a full-time author and speaker, addresses the 7 graduates and 3 faculty and a few guests. All men, mostly about 22 years old, that you went straight to seminary, college and seminary were the same thing back then, prepared to assume the Unitarian ministry. Among one of the more prestigious careers at the time, those were the days, few of them will leave the Boston area. One made it as far as Philadelphia. One got all the way to Albany. But like a viral TED talk, it wasn't the actual event that made history. It was the text of the essay, republished in 1,000 journals and tracts, and later in your American literature textbooks. I bet most of you read it in college, right? Or high school. Surely, a few years later, when Thatcher Blake helped start the Unitarian Church in Rockford in 1841, they were discussing the essay. Emerson's first words, In this refulgent summer, when it has been a luxury to draw the breath of life, locates his theology in the natural world. It was 2 years earlier when he had written the essay Nature, the foundational document of transcendentalism. Why nature? Because nature is our home. The world has its own beauty, its own truth, a truth larger than our own lives. And yet we are not apart from it, but part of it. It is like truth, and even heresy for 1838, and even for today, it is like God, larger than us, but we are part of it. And we don't need a mediator or interpreter to experience nature. Oh, sure, in the same way that a historian might make our reading of the Bible more informed, a scientist or a naturalist might make us appreciate nature even more, and certainly care for it better. But you can just go outside. You can just look out the window. You can just breathe the air. You can just go into the woods, and there it is, the world, older and larger and more than you, but not apart from you. Emerson said to the preachers in that room that their job was not to recite old doctrines or repeat what famous men had said before, but to preach soul, soul, soul. To remind their listeners that God speaketh not spake, and that the evidence for this is in nature, not just in the wildness, but also in the human heart, in the quest for the good, because we are nature too. In our longing for beauty and justice and hope, there is evidence that the holy lives in all things. It took a generation or so for the Unitarians and eventually the Universalists, who were more traditional, to embrace Emerson's teachings, but we did. And when we sing, "The wide universe is the ocean I travel," we sing Emerson. When we are moved by wonder to humility, to a feeling of awe, smallness and largeness at once, these feelings testify to the truth of his insight and to the continuing power of the world itself to shape us and hold us. Fast forward 120 years. A scientist and a member of All Souls Unitarian Church in DC has noticed through her research the devastating effects of pollution. Ecological systems are failing. Bird shells are too weak to protect the young. She wonders and she writes about the danger of a spring with no bird song at all, a silent spring. She gets some help from her fellow church member, William O. Douglas, the Supreme Court Justice, and gets the book published in 1962, just 2 years before she dies of cancer, a book that changed the world. Rachel Carson in D.C., and activists in California, and farmer naturalists in Wisconsin, and thousands of others who shouted, "The world is not just for our use. It has its own purpose. It is not right for us to destroy it and trash it and set it aflame." A lot of progress has been made in the years since then. But of course, now climate change looms over us, larger than so many of the other challenges we have faced and solved. Cannot always seem to deal with it as a nation, but thousands of groups of citizens, including folks led by members here at this church, are making changes that can be made at the local level. Because we never wish to wake to the silence of the birds. The ecological movement was embraced by Unitarian Universalists in the 60s and 70s, and not just because Carson herself was one of us. We were primed by transcendentalism to see the natural world as holy, as a place of wonder. The ethic of care flowed from that sense of wonder. If something is sacred, you don't just want to see it, you want to protect it and honor it. What was more surprising was the way that embracing ecological concerns changed us. We didn't just embrace recycling and start using LED lights eventually. We started natural prairies and preserved open spaces. And more than that, through ecological thinking, we made space for religious naturalism and process theology and panentheism, a word I'll explain, into our faith and theology. Panentheism is everything is in God. Charles Hartshorne is a name you should know, a Unitarian minister and a bird watcher. He wrote 4 or 5 books about theology and 2 about bird watching. He lived to be 101. It's pretty impressive. He had already written, before the ecological movement began, about a new vision of God. A God that was not separate, not an unmoved mover, not a noun, but a verb, a process, a lure, L-U-R-E, a lure, a felt movement that was present in everything. He called it panpsychism, that the consciousness of the holy wasn't apart from the world, but present in every single part of it, the blooming seed I am holding in my hand. Small pieces of granite, pyrite, schist, each one just now so thoroughly asleep. So just as Unitarian Universalism was, by and large, but not completely, putting aside an orthodox God, a God who controlled our fates from on high, just as we were saying that no God worth believing in would allow the Holocaust, the murder of 6 million Jews, just as we were saying no to that God, a new vision of the holy came into view. You didn't even have to call it God. You could just call it life, capital L, or spirit of life, or mystery. And this spirit of life didn't need us to worship it. It just was like the river that flowed through. But we could try to live in harmony with the spirit. We could open our hearts to how the spirit moved in us, in all things, and connected us. A third and final turning point in this story. 43 years after Rachel Carson published her book, at our General Assembly, our national annual meeting, we Unitarian Universalists voted to amend our organizing document and add a 6th source that we drew from the spiritual wisdom, we wrote, of spiritual teachings of earth-centered traditions, which celebrate the sacred circle of life and instruct us to live in harmony with the rhythms of nature. I was there. I was 18. And it was 1995 in Spokane, Washington. That's where the meeting was that year. It's where the meeting will be again next year. I sat in the balcony of the Opera Hall where the meeting were and watched the delegates debate the wording of the phrase, because we do everything democratically, and talk about transcendentalism and process theology and how we had begun to welcome pagans and neo-pagans into our churches and folks who wanted to revive old ways of being in touch with the earth, with the turning of the seasons and the ancient stories of our ancestors, and wanted a place to do that in conversation with others, in a multi-religious place with us. And that the statement that we were going to vote on would acknowledge what was already true, and it passed. Not without some debate, but it passed. But the truth is that it didn't just acknowledge what was already true. It changed us. Because we had put on paper that folks whose spirituality wasn't just inclusive of the earth, but was centered on the earth, were part of our story. And that meant that more and more pagans came to worship with us, and that we started celebrating the turnings of the year more intentionally, especially the pagan New Year, Samhain, October 31st. It meant that we got a little bit out of our head and a little bit into our bodies, just a little. It meant that we began to expand our metaphors for the holy even more. It meant that we started to say, blessed be, along with amen and shalom. And it meant that when the religious right attacked us in the 1990s for being home to, and I quote, atheists, hippies, members of the ACLU and the teachers' union. Oh, we're not done with the list yet. Feminists, radical gay right advocates, and even witches. We said, damn right, Skippy. Embracing pagans as part of our faith has made some folks a little nervous, it's true. In the same way that some traditional Unitarians were concerned about those nature-loving transcendentalists. But I think it'll work out. We move and adapt and grow and learn and change. I said a third and final movement in this story, but actually a movement is underway among us now. As we grow more and more committed as a matter of faith, as an application of our commitment to universalism, to the proposition that we must dismantle white supremacy and work for racial and economic justice, some have wondered what comes of our ecological concerns. But they are not separate things. Next year's Unitarian Universalist Common Read is a book on this by my friends Jennifer Nordstrom and Manish Mishra Mazzetti called Justice on Earth. And it's about how the struggle for racial justice and ecological justice are woven together. It is the same struggle. Go back to the beginning. If the holy is incarnate everywhere and in everyone, then we live differently. The crackdown on refugees is a precursor, it's a rehearsal to the limits that some will try to place on climate refugees. That's coming. It's already here. Those climate refugees will be mostly brown and black folks, and they will come for their survival to the very places that made their lands uninhabitable with our addiction to carbon. Where do dumps get built? And why is there still lead in the ground in some neighborhoods? And why, for that matter, is animal an insult? The answers to these questions are obvious when you begin to think about them. When we don't see the earth as part of us, it's also easy to fail to notice that other people are part of us too. That we are one family, one breathing life. All residents of one boat sailing through the heavens together. In this refulgent summer, my prayer for all of us is this, that we move from our hymn of praise to our song of peace. Begin with wonder, with awe, with the power of life itself, the river, the flowers. Be amazed. Let that wonder, that humility, that interconnection move you to act. From praise to peace, to live your own personal life with lightness and integrity wherever you can. To build a world that cares for the earth and all its people, no exceptions. To sing a song of peace and live a song of peace on this, our blue-green home. May it be so. Amen. Shalom. Blessed be. I invite you to rise.